Welcome to Made in Science, the official podcast of the University of Stuttgart. Today, our guest is Dr. Thilo Hagendorf. He is research group leader specializing on ethics of generative artificial intelligence. Some keywords of his research are digitalization, social media, big data, data protection, virtual reality, and media ethics. I want to talk with him about some of the laws of robotics, forbidden knowledge, and why he cycled nonstop for 500 kilometers. Hello, Dr. Hagendorf.
Hi, thanks for inviting me.
You have a very wide variety of interest, as I just said. At the same time, you seem to be also very happy about all of these interests and feel comfortable in them. You are a book author, a renowned speaker. For instance, you do Science Slam videos. You are world record holding cyclists, and you are an animal ethicist. My question is, how do you see yourself? Are you a philosopher? Are you a computer scientist? Are you both, or are you more?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to pigeonhole myself, so to say. I'm trained in the humanities, so I studied philosophy and cultural sciences and German literature and media sciences. And I even did a PhD in the humanities. But this is more than a decade. This happened more than a decade ago. Nowadays, my research is more or less purely focused on computer science and maybe a bit of psychology. So nowadays, I'd say I'm more of a computer scientist, or I would say AI safety, AI alignment, AI ethics researcher.
In your studies, and perhaps also beyond, you may have had an early interest in reading science fiction already. I'm not sure about that. I know about myself that I've been a reader of science fiction novels and stories since my teenage days, and that is a while ago. Of course, I came across the three laws of robotics that were described by Isaac Asimov in his short story, Runaround, published in 1942 in the magazine Astounding. There, Asimov talks about the basic rules of robot service. Do you know those three rules?
I think I could cite them, yes.
Okay, let's sort of do a little recap. A robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. A robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law. Now, from an ethical point of view, can you comment on these rules, please?
Yeah, I'd say in theory, these principles sound quite nicely, but the crux is to put them into practice. And I would say they are, a bit oversimplified. So what is harm? What does it mean that a human is in control of an autonomous system? Why is it important that a robot or a robotic entity protects its own existence? I think there are many more open questions that would have to be clarified.
Could it also be that hierarchical systems of rules are not in place when it comes to ethics?
So they're different schools of thought in ethics, and one school, deontology, is focused on rules, universal rules, and you can put these rules in a hierarchy. There are other theories that are more about balancing benefits and harms, which would be utilitarianism. I think the problem with deontology or rule-based ethics and AI systems is that AI systems are probabilistic machines that you cannot engineer rules into these systems. Rules are just not important for them.
Now, in your own work, what are some of the ethical goals that you want to set, check or do research on in AI?
That's really complicated, because in AI ethics, there are a plethora of ethical issues, starting with things like fairness, safety, transparency, interaction risks, the avoidance of toxicity or harmful content, impacts on specific societal fields, like what does AI mean for education? What does it mean for labor displacement? What does it mean for writing, etc.? And in my research, I'm not solely focused on one of these ethical clusters, but I'm a very curious person, so I have research projects that pertain to various of these issues.
So there's a variety in that area for you also. For your current work right now, as we are talking this week, is there a specific focus that you could share with us?
Yes. So a specific topic that's of interest for me right now is deception in AI systems. So initially, I came up with the idea of what I call machine psychology. The basic idea here is to treat generative AI systems, most of all large language models, as participants in psychology experiments, or in experiments that are inspired by human psychology. And this way you can discover lots of very interesting emergent abilities in these language models. For instance, we found out that they have something like an artificial theory of mind. So they have an understanding of false beliefs in other agents, for instance. And this led me to think about deception. So are language models able to purposefully induce false beliefs in other agents? And turns out they can do this. And now we want to dive deeper into this field. And right now we investigate what we call deception attacks. So can attackers manipulate language models in a way that they deceive or subtly deceive in a particular topic? And yes, you can do this. And this is obviously a huge risk. This is misinformation risk. And we also want to involve all the big labs, OpenAI, Google DeepMind, Anthropic, in this so that they can fix this vulnerability that we just discovered.
Against this background, I came across the term forbidden knowledge in one of your publications. Please, can you explain that term to us?
Yeah, what I just said is a nice segue to this, because what we found out, like this vulnerability, you could say, oh, we shouldn't publish this. We shouldn't describe this in a paper and just put it on the internet, because this is, yeah, forbidden knowledge. It is knowledge that can be easily abused. And actually, lots of research in the AI field is so-called dual-use research. So you can use it both for good and for bad purposes, to like say it very roughly. And I once wrote a paper on forbidden knowledge in the machine learning field, where I argued that a simple approach with open access to papers is maybe not the best solution for some research fields, we should have something like staged publications or no publications at all, right? So you just share your knowledge with certain other researchers because it's simply a safety threat if you publish it.
You are also a member of several working groups on AI governance. Please, can you give us an example for recent topics that you have looked at as a member of such working groups?
Yeah, so I cannot talk about everything because some of this stuff is secret. So for instance, I am part of the OpenAI Red Teaming Network, where we get access to unpublished models. And red teaming means that you play the role of an attacker and you attack the systems. And once you discover vulnerabilities, you share them with the developers. And other commissions where I'm part of, for instance, look at the governance of AI systems that the German police is using, or AI systems that are deployed in public places like train stations. So they have intelligent video surveillance there and other techniques. And we reflect on these AI systems. We try to avoid that, ideas that, I would say, have negative ethical implications are put into practice. So yeah, lots of different topics, but I think this is important work because this really has an impact, that you can, feel in a very direct sense.
Talking about impact, and since you just mentioned it, I could imagine that some of the topics that you work on in the field of AI cannot be limited to one particular country, to Germany, for that matter. You also, I guess, play a role or work with the AI Act in Europe. If so, how does that work look like? How does the European dimension look like? Is it a worldwide dimension can it be, I'm not seeing it restricted, can it be applied to certain bigger regions?
That's a good question. First of all, I have to admit I'm not a legal scholar, so I'm not an expert when it comes to the AI Act. I think there was at least subtle influence that we researchers had in the early days of the AI ethics field when we discussed different sets of principles that are important for AI systems. Back in the days, these were like discriminatory machine learning systems, like architectures that were used to classify and predict and find clusters and things like that. There was no generative AI like we are used to it nowadays. So lots of things also changed in the meantime. But I think the academic discourse indeed had an effect on the AI Act, but an effect that you cannot measure. I'm just speculating here. So yeah, a slight effect maybe also of my work, because I have one particular paper, like meter study, that looked at AI ethics guidelines, which came out in 2020. And this has, I think, more than 200,000 accesses and is cited nearly 2,000 times now. So I think this had maybe a certain impact on the legal discourse as well. And other than that, I cannot really assess the consequences of the AI Act also in countries other than the ones in Europe. I think I'm not entitled to say something about that. I'm not an expert in this.
You worked for the Cluster of Excellence Machine Learning at the University of Tübingen, and you were also a visiting scholar at Stanford University and UC San Diego in the United States. As a lecturer, you teach at the Hasso-Plattner Institute in Potsdam, among others. Now, what makes the University of Stuttgart a good place to do your research at?
So lots of universities in Germany say that interdisciplinary research is very important, but it is very seldomly at the core of what universities do. This is different in Stuttgart. So in especially on the campus in Vaihingen, I think there are so many genuinely interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary research projects that it's actually sometimes even hard to keep track of the plethora of different research topics that are pursued. And this is what I like about Stuttgart. They are not just saying that interdisciplinary research is important. They are doing it. And that's also, I think, why my place, or that's why it's good to situate my research in Stuttgart as well.
In this particular context, I assume you are also a member of IRIS, the Interchange Forum for Reflecting on Intelligent System at our university. Now, once we know that IRIS is a platform to promote critical reflection on intelligent systems and also their impact on society, where do you see society these days reflecting on artificial intelligence?
So I think the discourse is mostly driven by the big media outlets. And my perception is that lots of articles are very negative. I'd even go so far to say that there is a strong negativity bias in the way journalists in Germany talk about AI systems. And I think this is a problem. I think it's very important to be to have a critical mindset, but I think it's also important to look at the facts and to not be critical towards certain technologies just for the sake of being critical. So I think it is very important that we embrace generative AI systems and use them and adapt them, because they have the potential to change our lives significantly to the better. That doesn't mean that there are problems. We should fix the problems. We should shed light on the problems. But only focusing on the problems, and because there are problems, having, so to say, abolitionist approach and say, no, we don't want this, like no ChatGPT. So I think this is not a savvy way of dealing with new technologies. But this is also, from a psychological perspective, this is something that's a natural reaction, because whenever disruptive technologies were introduced to society, like be it the printing press, be it photography, be it TV, be it the internet, social media, and nowadays generative AI systems, there was always a phase of chaos in the beginning. And after this chaos, cultures find ways to come up with norms to deal with these technologies. That does also not mean that there are not certain long-term effects, and there are also negative long-term effects. But all in all, technology is making our lives safer and more luxurious, easier. We have a huge problem with sustainability, but we have to fix this, of course, first and foremost. And this is, of course, caused by technologies. But technologies have a role to play, and an important one. And especially, we lack a positive vision for AI systems, what they can do. They can transform health, education, the economy, and we need this positive vision. I think this is very important. And the media doesn't play a role in this, not at all. I don't see it.
One area you have a huge potential influence on is certainly the education of students here at the university. Therefore, looking ahead perhaps a little bit as well, what do you think, where are we standing with implementing ethics of artificial intelligence in the curricula, in the seminars and lectures, making students aware of what it means, how they can deal with it, those who want to be teachers in the future, for instance, but also those developing new systems in other areas. So where do we stand with that? And do you have any suggestions? Is that part of your work to also implement ethics of AI in the teaching programs?
Mm-hmm. It is part of many curricula. And I, of course, also teach it. But I think I teach it differently than many other lecturers in the same field. So most courses on computer ethics or AI ethics or technology ethics work like this. You nudge or force students to read texts from philosophy about abstract ethical theories, where sometimes the word technology or AI is included, but other than that, it's mostly philosophy. So very abstract. And there's research showing that such seminars literally have zero effect on behavior. So I have a different style of teaching. I either talk about purely or mostly technical issues with the students and how to fix certain problems in a technical manner. But there are some problems that cannot be fixed by technical means. So I also talk with them a lot about personality or character dispositions and motivations, or the traditional term would be virtues. And I talk a lot about the psychology of virtues and why people are not virtuous, because everyone thinks that fairness is important and honesty is important and not causing harm is important. And we have all these principles in our head, but we don't live up to them. We see this also in other areas like climate change or animal ethics or lots and lots of different other fields. So I talk to students about the obstacles that are in the way of us living up to certain virtues. So my courses are more psychology courses, actually, than philosophy courses. So that's what I make a bit different.
Talking about virtues and living up to principles, I would like to bring the audience to the attention that you had a very, very successful life in sports. Perhaps that is still going on. You have been a competitive cyclist for nearly 20 years. You have competed in national as well as international championships. And in addition to race wins on the road and in mountain bike marathons, you also liked ultra bike marathons. In fact, you did a 500 kilometer nonstop ride for a good cause. Now, that is about the distance between Stuttgart and Amsterdam all the way through. And in 2021, you achieved the 12-hour altitude world record. What does it take for you to be such a competitive, but perhaps beyond that, also very engaged sports person. And does that influence your work?
And I don't even know whether I can answer this question. I just always enjoyed the freedom that you have when you're on the bike. And I did lots of races, and then came COVID. And then I was like, okay, what am I going to do now? So that's why I started these like more individual or individualistic projects, ultra cycling projects, basically. And yeah, nowadays, I have a wonderful daughter. Maybe some listeners heard her already in the background. But that means that my second professional life basically came to an end. And now, but that's not a problem. I mean, I enjoyed it a lot, and I'm still on the bike a lot, but not on the level that I once had. What does it mean for my work? I think I learned a lot from sports for my style of working as well. In particular, being concentrated for long periods of time, being focused and being, yeah, disciplined. So I think these are very positive effects that my sporting life had on my working life.
Now, also for our topic, that was one part of your life. There is another one. You also did undercover investigations for several years, actually, on factory farms. And with your discoveries, you also actually won an award in Germany. The footage of your work led to an award-winning media report and documentaries airing at major German TV broadcasters. Then there was also a book publication about the practices inside factory farming and the societal as well as ecological ramifications thereof. You used your insights that you had from your undercover investigations, as well as your scientific background in animal ethics. Please, can you tell us about some of these initiatives, how these two fields, these two areas actually came together?
I don't know whether there's such an overlap. I think my background in academia really helped in writing the book, because I also reviewed lots and lots of papers for this book, and papers that pertain to agriculture, of course. But nevertheless, this helped a lot. Other than that, I think these are a bit separated topics. So when I was 20, I was watching a documentary. It's called Earthlings. And the documentary shows footage from slaughterhouses and factory farms all over the world. And when I saw these images, I was traumatized, I think. I was so shocked about what is going on, that this had an immediate impact on my own habits, consumption habits, eating habits, of course. And later on, I also said, I have to do something about this problem, because we are slaughtering 70 billion land animals every year. So this is an amount of suffering that is beyond any imagination. Now, many people think, oh, the situation is better in Germany. We have animal welfare laws and things like that. But the situation is as dire in Germany as it is in other countries as well. And it was when I did my PhD, like, there was not much structure in your life, right? You just read lots of books and do lots of writing. So I could spend some weeks in factory farms, or I could go on trips during the night and film in factory farms, put hidden cameras in factory farms, and pick them up a few days later. And yeah, we did this. for several years and found like horrific stuff, which we already expected. This led to certain scandals in Germany as well. I hope it improved the situation of some animals a bit. And then I also wrote a book about it.
And just one follow-up question. You gave us a number of animals that are killed. That regards in Germany, beyond Europe, where?
Worldwide, this is 70 billion. For like fish, it's way more than 70 billion. It's trillions, I guess. No one can count them because this is fish are just weighed in tons, not individuals. In Germany, it's 750 million animals every year. And this is basically completely hidden. Like, have you ever seen one of these 750 million animals? I don't think so. People don't see these animals. Where are they? And my motivation was to show that here they are. And this is how they are living, and this is how they are raised and killed. And I think most people who see this can no longer support this system.
I can certainly testify to some of your findings. As a pupil, I also worked on a chicken farm, the pictures from that, when I heard you just talking about it, certainly are back in my mind. That was not encouraging. And worldwide, I guess, we see huge problems in that area. Dr. Hagendorf, we started by looking at Asimov's three rules for robots. Now, towards the end of our conversation, I wonder if you have also three rules for the ethics of AI that you are testing, that you perhaps already have in your mind and use them as a thesis, or that you already have found. If so, and on whatever level these are, please, can you share them with us?
Good question. I think I would have to spend some time reflecting on it. Maybe some abstract rules are that, first of all, scientific rigor is very important for me, especially the field that I'm working in right now, like evaluating machine behavior and generative AI systems. This is such a new field. There is not so much methodological rigor established. And for me, it's very important to have sound experiments and accurate experiments. This is, of course, a very important rule for me. Then what's also like guiding for my work is that I'm interested in what's going on currently, like right now, like what are traits of the latest versions of the most cutting edge frontier AI systems that are available. This is also very important for me. It sounds like maybe obvious, but it has a caveat. The intrinsic problem of this is that you constantly have to learn new things. So there are no recipes for what we are doing. We fail a lot in what we are doing, in coding, in our hypothesis, in our approaches. But failing is important. It's part of the game. And failing should be motivating to continue. And this is maybe my third, I don't know whether I should call it a rule, but something that's important for me is when something is intimidating, and when something seems complicated, you should do it. You should not back up from it, but see it as a reason, actually. to tackle it. Curiosity, the curiosity and the interdisciplinary approach that I embrace in my research. This means that I constantly try to learn new things. Yeah, this is important for me.
I think all of these three may be excellent topics for one of your next science slams that are available on YouTube and on another media. So please go for it. That would be my recommendation and wish.
Thanks.
For the final part of our conversation, we have a particular section that we call Moment 7. We have collected 7 questions that we would like to ask you. And please answer them as shortly as possible. Moment 1. Spätzle or Maultaschen?
Spätzle.
Moment 2. One thing that you could change about the world would be?
Make it more plant-based.
Moment 3. Which media recommendation, a book, music, movie, do you have for our audience?
Yeah, watch Dominion. It's a documentary.
Moment 4. An advice that you would give to our audience is?
Never be afraid to deviate from the norm.
Moment 5. Your favorite place at the University of Stuttgart is?
The pond next to the cafeteria.
Moment 6. Please complete this sentence. If I could start all over again, I would do the following differently.
If I could start all over again, I would study computer science in the beginning.
And finally, moment 7. Thanks to my studies, I know that
large language models are more than just stochastic parrots. Maybe just insiders will understand this, but this is something that I learned.
Well, we welcome insiders. We welcome everybody else as well here. And most of all, we welcome that you were part of our conversation on Made in Science today. Dr. Hagendorf, thank you so much for your insights. And wishing you and your team all the very best and great success in your research.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And to our audience, please stay tuned for our next conversations that are always based on what is made in science. My name is Wolfgang Holtkamp. Have a great podcasting day. Goodbye and good talking.